Welcome you to the court for our last day of oral argument in the September calendar. 06AP 1811 CR State versus Patrick Carter. Mr. Winsler, you have 25 minutes representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the court. I'm Warren Weinstein, Assistant Attorney General. I represent the state of Wisconsin in this appeal.
Excuse me, Mr. Weinstein, I cannot hear you. So I don't know what the problem is. Well, it's mutual. He can't hear you. So you'll have to speak into the microphone, and maybe, do you think you should raise
the tenor or something for him?
Actually, I'm having a little trouble hearing the justices also.
Right. I don't want you to get started, then.
Sorry, I apologize.
That's better. That it's better? Not your fault. Yeah, it's our equipment. Thank you very much.
Seems to me this case boils down to this concept that referred to in the two earliest Supreme Court cases, State versus Beats and State versus Betcher, as dual credit, meaning that when a person serves or gets credit for one day of confinement, it actually applies on two, and depending on the number of concurrent sentences, can be more days for each of those 1 days of actual service of the sentence. Betcher rejects that proposition for consecutive sentences. And this case presents the question of whether or not in the case where concurrent sentences are not imposed at the same time, that proposition should or should not apply. The Court of Appeals has assumed in a number of cases that it does not apply, and that for concurrent sentences, if you get sentence credit on one concurrent sentence, you get sentence credit on a second one, even if it's imposed later.
And where do you get that from? Some language in Ward?
I'm sorry?
Where do you get that proposition from?
Well, the proposition in the Court of Appeals,
yes.
The most striking example of it is State versus Ward.
Okay.
If you trace, it's mentioned in a couple of other cases also.
Right.
If you trace it back, it really goes back to State versus Beats and State versus Betcher. The problem is that...
Counsel, before you do that, you are working under the assumption, I think, that the time spent in the Illinois jail before sentencing for the Illinois crime is in connection with the Wisconsin crime. I mean, that is your assumption in starting your argument today.
Well, I think that's one of the things that this case calls into question, because as I see it, if you look at the cases, there are two separate ways in which one crime can be in connection with another. One has to do with the underlying facts of the case, where the evidence of one case, one crime would prove an element or the other, or it's a lesser included offense, or something of that nature. The other is where there, for some procedural reason, the cases are linked to each other, because there was an outstanding warrant on both at the time of the arrest, because the sentencing occurred.
This falls into your second category.
I'm sorry?
This case falls into your second category.
Yes,
they are linked because he is sitting in Illinois because there's a State of Wisconsin warrant, and he is sitting in Illinois because he's being held for an Illinois crime, right?
That's right. He was, when he was arrested, there was actually a 2-day difference, but we didn't make an issue of that.
I understand.
Yes, he was, when he was arrested, he had an outstanding Wisconsin warrant, and he was also arrested on a felony in Illinois.
Is it the state's position that when you're sitting in jail for two reasons, Illinois and Wisconsin here, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there is a Wisconsin connection between the Wisconsin arrest and the ultimate Wisconsin conviction, right?
The connection is that the arrest occurred at the same time on both offenses.
Yeah, but he was arrested for the crime in Wisconsin that he was ultimately convicted of.
Right.
Okay, so my question to you is, if you have somebody in jail for two reasons, right, is that good enough to give him sentence credit, or does it have to be exclusively in connection with the Wisconsin crime?
I don't like the term exclusively.
Okay, but use whatever term you like. You use the term exclusively in your brief.
Our position in, that's because that's the language that happens to make its way into the into the special materials. But our position is that to be in connection with it, what the legislature intended in adopting that language is that the underlying facts of the case are related, not merely the fact that the arrest occurs at the same time. And the exception to that, which we would recognize, is Ward, where when you have sentences imposed on all imposed on the same day, you effectively negate the sentence credit entirely.
Counselor Ward, there was an agreement, though, that they were held in connection with the same crime. So I don't think that issue was ever really up for dispute in Ward. If it had been, maybe Ward wouldn't have come out as Ward did. What do you think about that?
I think that it's accurate to say that the Ward court, I don't remember whether the state contested the in connection with or not in Ward, but I know that the circuit court, when it made its decision, in effect held that they were not the two concurrent sentences that it didn't give credit for were not in connection with the one it got, they gave the credit for, and the Court of Appeals certainly disagreed with that, yes. So after Ward, at least as the Court of Appeals jurisprudence stood, at least for all sentences imposed at the same time, that would be enough to make the cases in connection with.
Well, if you read it right out of the statute, you read the conduct part right out of the statute when you do that, and really the reason you're giving them sentence credit, at least in part, is to try to comply with the legislative directive, correct?
The legislative, yeah, as the language of the statute states it, yes.
And my concern is that I think that Ward may be overly interpreted by some of the courts that have relied on it, because the question about whether the incarceration or the hold before sentencing was in connection with the same conduct was never addressed by the court. And my understanding is there was an agreement among counsel for the state and counsel for the defendant, that they weren't going to go on that basis. They were just going to let that issue ride as though they were in connection with the same crime, whether or not they were.
I think that's happened in a number of Court of Appeals decisions, and that's part of the reason I think that this body of law has kind of developed in the Court of Appeals that gives rise to the concept that all concurrent sentences give rise to
I agree with you. And so here, I'd like you to explain carefully, because it's my view that I at least need to understand this issue and decide this issue, whether it has to be in connection with the same course of conduct, as the Chief said, to exclusively, or if it's however you want to address that issue, but I don't want to just let it slide by.
I think our position in this case is that for a crime to be in connection with the course of conduct, it has to be facts of the I'll state it, and then I want to explain a little, because one of the problems is terminology.
Yep, of course.
The facts of the case have to give rise to both crimes for which the person's sentenced. Now the problem is that if you focus too much on crime or offense, what happens is that when you have a plea bargain that substitutes a different crime, like for instance in the lesser included situation, then you give rise to the argument that you're not entitled to sentence credit on the lesser included offense because it's a different offense. And I think that's one of the reasons that the legislature chose the broader language that it did. Mm-hmm. But I don't think the legislature meant to broaden that language so much that merely a sentencing on the same on a concurrent sentence, just because somebody happens to be already serving a sentence, so the judge makes a determination that based on that other sentence combined with this sentence, total incarceration ought to be X amount of time, that kind of thing makes them in connection with. And I think that's one of the things this case calls into question.
So let me just ask you, you have an Illinois crime, which is not connected with the Wisconsin crime, right?
I'm sorry?
There's an Illinois crime here, and it is not connected with the Wisconsin
not
crime.
Not factually in any
not
way.
Not in any way, right?
Right. Okay. The robbery, the...
All right. So he's sitting in Illinois in the jail for an Illinois crime. That is, accused of an Illinois crime, and he's in the jail pre-trial, right?
He was in pretrial custody in Illinois.
Right, for an Illinois case.
Yes.
And in a totally unconnected Wisconsin case, he is also in jail. They're holding him there, right? Because there's paper from Wisconsin saying, hold him or give him to us.
Well, it wasn't just a detainer. And here again, we get into some terminology.
You don't have, none of that is in the record. The Illinois papers,
well,
or the Wisconsin papers are not in the record.
What's in the record, and all of this came in, and again, this is one of the problems with sentence credit cases, the way they tend to come up, is that the record generally relies on defense counsel to put it in the post-conviction motion or the 973-15.
Let me just get to the basic point. Is it your position in this case that his being in the Illinois jail is not in connection with the Wisconsin crime to which he is sentenced? If that's your position, we don't have to worry about all the days and front end, back end. Is your position that under no conditions in this case does he get any credit in Wisconsin?
Until he's actually surrendered to Wisconsin, that's correct.
Where do you write that in your brief? Where is that in your brief?
Well, I didn't say it in the brief because the judge gave him credit for that all that time.
But you're objecting to all that credit.
No, I'm not. Once he's surrendered to Wisconsin.
I know, but that happens after he's sentenced in Illinois and after he's serving some time in Illinois, right?
He received, I can't remember the exact number of days, but it's from the time that he was surrendered from the Wisconsin authorities up until his sentencing
He was in the Illinois jail from December 14th, 2003 to November 2, 2004. That's
right.
324 days.
Right, and then he was surrendered sometime in early May.
And he was sentenced and convicted in November 4, or thereabouts.
Right.
And then, what did he do from November 4, 2004?
Apparently he was in the Illinois prison system.
Okay. In May, Wisconsin gets their hands on him.
Right.
Right? And he is ultimately, in August, pleads guilty, right? And sentenced.
They got him back through, I think, the interstate agreement on detainer.
All right. Is the fight about the 324 days spent from December 14th, 2003 to November 2, 2004? Is that what the fight's about?
I think that's the time he spent in the, I'm sorry, did you say?
The time spent in the Illinois jail before he is convicted in Illinois.
Right.
Is that what we're fight, what the fight is between you
yes,
and
that's,
the, okay.
That's the time,
all
that's
right.
The, that's the.
All right. Yeah. Is that time spent in connection with the Wisconsin crime?
If
I want to know what the state
under,
says.
Under our view?
Yes.
No.
It is not. And where is that in your brief? Because I totally misunderstood your brief.
I guess the way I said that is that I believe that the Court of Appeals misapplied State versus Ward when they granted him credit for that period of time.
Could I ask? It is December 14th, 2002. Excuse me, December 14th, 2003. Mr. Carter is arrested in Illinois.
Why?
The record is a little sketchy on this. What we have is, I think, some booking sheets which say he's arrested on robbery, that's an Illinois crime, DUI, that was an Illinois crime, and then something, then a notation of an extradition cases.
But did the Illinois police have a warrant for his arrest in Wisconsin, and they just sort of discovered the robbery and the DUI afterwards?
I don't think they did at the time that they actually took him into custody, but 2 days later, he was served with a fugitive warrant, which is an Illinois warrant that issues on the filing of notification, if you will, of a...
Would anything have changed if they had not known about the crime in Wisconsin?
I think under the Court of Appeals jurisprudence as it currently exists, he would not be entitled to credit if Wisconsin didn't find out about him until he was already in the Illinois prison system and then brought him back through the interstate agreement on detainers. At least as to that portion that he spent in pretrial detention from arrest to sentencing in Illinois, I don't think under the current case law he would be entitled to that credit.
But wouldn't he have been in incarceration in Illinois for those 324 days? In any event?
I think he probably... Well, I don't know Illinois law well enough to be able to answer that question with any real confidence, but I think in the absence of Illinois setting bail and all of that sort of thing, yes, he would have had to deal with Illinois' pretrial law, whatever it is, pretrial incarceration law, whatever it is, as to his Illinois felonies. And if Illinois wouldn't bail him or he couldn't make bail or whatever, then he would have been held on the Illinois charges regardless of whether Wisconsin charges were pending or not.
And Wisconsin can't bring him back here to be in court on these charges until Illinois is done, right? That's why he wasn't brought into Wisconsin until later, until after he received his prison sentence, until the Illinois court entirely ran its course, right?
And that's my understanding, unless for some reason Illinois just voluntarily surrendered him to Wisconsin. But under the Extradition Act, there's a specific provision in there that says we don't get him until after Illinois is done. And the interstate agreement doesn't kick in until he's actually incarcerated in Illinois.
I've seen extradition warrants come into court. They're drafted up. They have the attached paperwork from the other state on them. And then you come in and you give the person the right to an identification hearing and then potentially set bond. And then there's a certain time frame within which they need to go to their other state, unless there's something they need to deal with in their home state or the state where they're currently existing. Extradition warrants. When they come into court, they have the attached paperwork from the state that wants them, right? And then a hearing is held, and if the person contests that that's them, then they can contest that, and an identification hearing occurs, right?
If you're talking about, well, here again, there's a little bit of a terminology problem. If by extradition warrant you mean the governor's warrant, the warrant the governor issues after the preliminary states do their review, the answer to that question is yes. If you're referring to what this record refers to as a fugitive warrant, then the answer is no. Usually the only thing you have is some NCIC hit that tells the law enforcement that there's a standing Wisconsin felon.
So this had not gotten to the stage where a governor's warrant had issued and extradition had begun?
No, he did not come back by extradition. From what I can tell, now the record is somewhat sketchy on this also, but from what I can tell, and this is based on an interchange between the assistant district attorney at a pretrial hearing, the assistant district attorney says, we have to try him within 120 days. Now, what that says to me is that he was brought back pursuant to the interstate agreement on detainer provision that says the state can get you back by demanding surrender from the asylum state, and the asylum state then surrenders him, and you have to try him within 120 days, or you have to dismiss the charge.
So he was held on an Illinois fugitive warrant until he was brought back by the interstate agreement on detainers.
Well, he was served with an Illinois fugitive warrant, i.e., an Illinois warrant based on outstanding Wisconsin charges. That was served 2 days after his arrest. There was never a governor's warrant issued, and I don't know why.
No bond set.
I don't know that either.
Okay.
As far as we know, the record doesn't disclose one, at least.
All right. Thank you. Counsel, I want to make sure I understand your argument, because I'm having difficulty. I look at your brief, page 7, the brief in chief, page 7, bottom right. And it says, because Carter was in custody on both the Illinois robbery and the outstanding fugitive warrant, according to the committee, I'm reading from the very bottom of page 7, according to the committee, you're referring to the jury instructions committee, he is not entitled to credit because that custody did not stem exclusively from the Wisconsin charges. The Court of Appeals rejected this reasoning. The state believes the Court of Appeals correctly analyzed the case law, which the committee cites in WIS-JI SM-34A. I interpreted that to mean that you agree with Judge Bergeron's analysis regarding the, if you will, erroneous interpretation of the criminal instructions committee with regard to SM-34A. Do I read that sentence or those sentences correctly or not?
I think so. What
are you challenging the Court of Appeals taking to task the language in 34A? In other words, saying that the criminal justice committee, I think, was it the Roloff case and the the Nyborg case or Deemer's case, those three cases.
I'm sorry.
The Court of Appeals got it right, jury instruction committee got it wrong. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So you're not fighting that
for
an issue?
No.
Okay. What you're fighting, as I understand it, is that your argument here today is that Ward does not apply. Is that what you're arguing here? Is that,
yes.
Is that the nut of your argument, that Ward does not apply?
It is.
What is the holding of Ward, in your opinion? So I want to know what part of Ward doesn't apply.
Well, I think Ward does not apply to to a case in which the concurrent sentences are imposed at different times.
That's right. And that you're not fighting on whether this is in connection with. Because you never get to this argument about Ward if you're fighting about what in connection with. You have to agree that it was in connection with to even get to the other question.
Well, what I'm saying is that when a court imposes a concurrent sentence
on a different
day, that alone is insufficient to make to make the case.
Right.
That's your argument here today.
I understood you to say in your brief.
Mr. Weinstein, I have a question, and it's coincidental that it's a follow-up of Justice Rogensack's question. She and I actually had it at the same time. But I think it's important to talk about Ward, because Ward is so often cited principally for the proposition that the sentences, concurrent sentences imposed on the same day necessarily result in sentence credit on all the sentences. Is that a fair and accurate summary?
I think that's the way Ward's been interpreted, yes.
Been interpreted, but isn't the substance of Ward, is it fair to say that the substance of Ward was in reality all of the sentences were in connection with the same underlying fact?
I think if you look at the facts of Ward, that's correct. Now, the Court of Appeals in its opinion doesn't base its holding on that.
If one, for instance, looks at the trial briefs that are on file at the State Law Library, one sees that it was very apparent to all the parties in the court at the time of sentencing that it didn't depend necessarily on the relatively randomness of the date of sentencing, but actually it accorded due respect to the fact that the underlying facts were connected.
I don't have, or didn't look at the underlying briefs, but I think that when I compare the facts of the case and ignore what the Court of Appeals says its reasoning is, I draw that conclusion.
From the substance of the facts, yes.
Counsel, I have one follow-up question to something Justice Bradley asked. In regard to an answer that you gave me, what I was trying to understand from you is if it was the state's position that this hold in Illinois was in connection with the same course of conduct as resulted in the Wisconsin sentence. And I believe you told me no. And that was one of the reasons why you were opposed to additional sentence credit. Then when Justice Bradley read from your brief, what she was pointing out is that the Court of Appeals is relying on Ward in this case, without getting under Ward's decision to see if the issue that's bothering me was really something the court addressed. It was my understanding from what you said that you do not think, on behalf of the state, that the Illinois hold was in connection with the same course of conduct as resulted in the Wisconsin sentence. Am I right or wrong?
I think the one thing you can tell from the facts of these cases, that is, if you look at the underlying offense conduct, that criminal acts, the underlying criminal acts, they had nothing to do with each other.
Okay.
One is a robbery, the other is a sexual assault.
Okay, so it's the state's position, it's not in connection with the same person.
The only connection that they have, if any, is the fact that he was arrested on a warrantless arrest in Illinois, or, if you will, setting aside all of the what paper was there, he was arrested on both offenses at the same time.
Well, and if that's the state's position, we never have to get into any sentencing credit, because we never have to get into sentencing credit, because they're not under the same facts. So the answer is no credit, and it wouldn't matter if it was concurrent on the same day, that the judges did it, or they do it several months afterwards.
I think it's not in connection.
The end. That's your position.
I think that's what the legislature intended when it adopted.
Well,
you
did a lot of charts here, and that's so. I suppose if you didn't accept that position, but let me move it into a state. Person is charged in Wisconsin and arrested for sexual assault and robbery And these robbery and sexual assault are not connected. Not the same day, not the same victim. Okay?
Okay.
And he's under arrest in his pre-sentence. He's in jail. Got it? Just like he is here. He is ultimately convicted only of the robbery. Sexual assault, he is not convicted. Now, he has been in jail for two offenses. He wants credit now for his pre-sentence confinement. Does he get it or not? Because he's not in jail exclusively for the sentence, for the crime, or the facts of the crime. Is he going to get credit or not? Because I want to take out of the picture all of the fuss as to what Wisconsin did, and whether it's on a detainer or something else, none of which is clear in this record.
Can I clarify that? Are you saying he's in cash bond on both cases?
Doing the same thing that happened here. He is in jail.
Well, okay.
If I understand, there are two outstanding warrants. He's arrested on both. He eventually is only convicted of one.
Right.
And the question is, does he get the sentence credit on that one? Well, I would say in that case, that's, I think, why that second sentence is in the statute that says if the custody is related to the crime upon which the person is sentenced. If he's sentenced on the armed robbery, and in part the custody was based on the armed robbery, then I think yes, he does get the credit.
Okay, what's different about this case than
because,
the example I gave?
Because in the case where there are two separate crimes, and the sentence is on one first and another one later, he's already gotten the credit.
Let's not get into that. I don't want to deal with that. I want to deal only whether it's in connection with the crime. Or does it have to be, he has to be exclusively in the jail for the one crime that he is convicted of. I want the exact same fact situation as here, except for the fact that we'll put it all in Wisconsin. That's all I want to know.
Right.
I want to know whether he gets any credit at all on the grounds of in connection with.
Well, I think that's exactly what the Vetcher Court had in mind when it said you get one day for one day to based on the total time of the total incarceration. And what it meant is, they applied that to consecutive sentences, but I think what I'm saying is when the sentences aren't imposed at the same time, that should bar application of sentence credit to both concurrent sentences. Now, I think that the hypothetical that you pose creates one of those difficult situations that the legislature was trying to address when it put in that second sentence, and that is, what happens if during the entire dynamic of the state and the defendant's litigation of this case, one of the cases goes away entirely? And that's true whether or not it's two separate crimes or whether or not it's lesser included, and the state agrees that they'll charge the lesser included and dismiss or substitute an information that doesn't charge the greater. The crime goes away, and the legislature says in those kind of situations we do want to give credit. But I think that is kind of an exception to the general in connection with based on the underlying facts. And I think the statute, I mean, I know you said you don't want to deal with exclusivity, but I think the statute makes you deal with it.
So your answer is it doesn't have to be exclusive, or it does have to be exclusive. What's your answer to that?
Well, I don't think you can answer that. I think you have to go into the statutory language and look at whether or not it meets the criteria for in connection with. And in some cases, exclusively may end up making a difference in that, in the conclusion of whether the crime is in connection with, and in other cases it won't.
So it doesn't have to be exclusively.
I don't think it necessarily has to be exclusively.
That's what all of that discussion in the Court of Appeals is about.
Again, because if exclusively I was addressing there was the way it's used in the jury instruction manual, or the special jury instruction materials. And in that case, the jury instruction materials seem to say that without exception, if it's not exclusively based on the Wisconsin crime, you don't get credit for it. I think that goes too far, because I think it's possible that that might make a difference, but I don't think it does in this case.
And this may be a good launching point, Mr. Weinstein, simply to make something express, which appears to be implied by the state's arguments and by your comments here today. You're not arguing that there's no credit. You're simply, is it fair to say you're taking the position there simply shouldn't be dual credit for those cases which don't share the same underlying factual basis?
Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weinstein. Ms. Hennick?
May it please the Court, my name is Ellen Hennick, and I represent Mr. Carter. When you're interpreting a statute, it's always a good idea to go back both to the statute and to the history of the statute. So before we get into whether this is Illinois or Wisconsin, let's go back and start with the statute and talk about what it was that the legislature was really trying to do here. Because I think when we keep talking about in connection with, we are mixing up some things. The statute reads, and I'm reading from 973.155, subsection 1, subsection A, a convicted offender shall be given credit toward the service of his or her sentence for all days spent in custody in connection with the course of conduct for which sentence was imposed. So it's any days for each sentence. So if you have two different sentences, if you have, say, an armed robbery and a sexual assault, whether they're served at the same time, different times, that happened at two different times. The concept is you get credit for any time that you were spending in custody in connection with that case. It doesn't matter whether the two cases are connected, at least not in the preliminary analysis.
Counsel, can I ask you, would it matter if you got a PR bond on one and a cash bond on the other in your analysis as to whether you get credit?
It might, because that might have to do with where you're held and when you're held.
Assume it brought in the same place and you get a PR bond on one matter and cash bond on another. Do you get credit on a PR bond for time you spend in custody on another different, separate bond?
I think we're jumping to this afternoon's case, and I really am, I can tell you what my answer is, but I was not prepared to go there, in part because I understood the argument today to be that the state was saying that what we have here is in connection. The question is whether it gets credited. So if it's all right with you, I'd like to think about that and come back to it for a minute or two, because I was not expecting to go there.
You say in your brief, maybe that was a mistake for me to rely on it, but it seemed to match the language. In fact, you say the parties agree that the Court of Appeals correctly held that neither SM34A, et cetera, apply. The parties currently agree the Court of Appeals below correctly held this case law and reasoning do not support denial of sentence credit, and then go on to the word exclusively.
Right. My understanding about what we were fighting about, and to some extent I was not originally the attorney below. I came in the middle of the Court of Appeals case. So for me, for some reason, this case has become a moving target in a way that most don't.
I think at the Court of Appeals, the state did argue, and I have the Court of Appeals briefs, specifically that the two conducts were unrelated and that the Wisconsin sentencing was not in connection with the hold in Illinois under the terms of the statute.
True, but they will rely on the SM34A, which they no longer are. So that's part of my confusion here.
I think that analytically,
if you go back, and I had a chance to think about what you're talking about. I think analytically, if you go back, the origin of this statute really came out of some equal protection concerns that this court first identified in a case called Klimas. And the concern was that somebody who can't make bail not spend more time than somebody who could. So if you have a PR bond, my answer would be if you had a PR bond, you're not held because you can't make bail.
Exactly.
Okay. So I think that that's what it would come down to.
It's really an indigency issue.
It's really at heart an indigency issue. And that's why what I've been suggesting is that you need to look at what happens to a rich defendant, and I will be honest with you when I say defendant R, I kept in my own mind saying rich defendant who can make bail, and a defendant who can't make bail. And when you look at it from that perspective, and we can get into what the Illinois thing does here, and I'd rather get into that separately because I think it's hard to mix them together. Okay, what I'd like to do with your permission is to step over to the side where I have some charts and walk you through what I think the analysis should be.
Go ahead. There's a microphone.
Well, Justice Prosser was just about to ask me a question.
Oh, okay. The defendant committed a sexual assault in Wisconsin.
Okay.
He fled to Illinois or moved to Illinois.
Okay.
He committed a robbery in Illinois.
Right.
And he was also a drunk driver.
Okay.
And he's arrested in connection with that robbery.
Okay.
And held in custody until he is tried, convicted, and sentenced.
Okay, he's arrested only on that robbery?
I don't think he was arrested in Illinois because of the sexual assault in Wisconsin.
Okay, so you're assuming that he's arrested only because of the Illinois robbery.
And held only for the Illinois robbery, I understand.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that. But he was arrested because he committed a robbery in Illinois. And they held him until they convicted him and sentenced him.
If, in fact, he was never actually arrested based on the Wisconsin case, I don't think there's any question that credit doesn't go.
Well, what's different in this case from what Justice Brotson gave you?
What's different in this case is when the police pick him up, and this is the difference with the SM34. We're not talking about cases where you're already in the Illinois prison and somebody puts a detainer on you. DeMars already says detainers don't actually hold you. In this case, however, the police say we are arresting him on, in this case, three different things, a DUI, a robbery, and the Wisconsin cases. I think you get into a lot of problems because the same scenario can happen in Wisconsin if you start trying to parse out, well, which arrest did they mean the most? And the only way that you can get to where the state is suggesting is if you start parsing out which arrest meant the most. Because when we're talking about spending time in connection with the case, we're saying, are you arrested and held on that case?
You have to be arrested and held. That's the 2 days. He was arrested only on the Illinois charges. I understand the facts. 2 days later, they find out that he's wanted for Wisconsin and papers are filed.
That is not my understanding. My understanding is the police ran the warrant, didn't have the warrant, but arrested him on the Wisconsin charges.
Suppose he didn't, and it's 2 days or 3 days later they find out he's still in jail for the Illinois arrest. They find out he's wanted in Wisconsin, and Wisconsin sends all these papers down indicating they want him back for trial ultimately, right? In one form or other. What's your answer to that?
My position has been, and this is because of DeMar's, that it has to be a piece of paper that Wisconsin recognizes as effectuating an arrest or a hold. So it depends on what kind of paperwork you're talking about. If it's merely an interstate detainer, I think under the case law we currently have, whether I agree with it or disagree with it, it's not sufficient.
How does that line up with your position that the statute is basically an indigency statute?
Because if he's held, I'm not sure that it does, and that's why I'm saying it. I'm not sure that I would, if I were starting this totally from scratch, I'm not sure I would construct the system. I'm not sure it's particularly, that I'm particularly prepared to sit down and say, well, the system should be. I'm working within the system as it's currently set up, and I'm not challenging DeMar's here.
I think, oh, I'm sorry, were you done?
I was going to try and get to the chart, but go ahead.
I think one of the fundamental questions here, though, is why was he being held in between December 14, 2003, and up to the date of sentencing, November 2nd, 2004? In your opinion, why was he being detained in Illinois?
There were two reasons. He was being detained in Illinois because he couldn't make bail on the Illinois case. Had he made bail on the Illinois case, he still would have been held because of Wisconsin.
How do you know that?
Because my understanding is that, and it's not based on this record, because
right.
I did not construct this record. Based on what I know of how this works in Illinois, I could give you an answer. But can I give it to you from this record? No, I can't.
There's no way of knowing on this.
There's no way of knowing on this record.
They could have cut him loose. If he had been determined not to, for whatever reason, they weren't going to go forward on the prosecution in Illinois on the conduct that occurred there, they could have let him loose.
Theoretically, I suppose they could have decided under their governor's warrant or whatever they had. I guess there wasn't one here.
Or
they could have turned him loose theoretically. Now, having said that,
excuse me.
All right. I'm sorry. I'm trying to follow where you're going.
I think you answered my question. Now I'm going to ask another one.
Okay.
Or they could have initiated the more formalized process of extraditing him back to Wisconsin, such as by providing a bail hearing on the Wisconsin charge. True?
That's theoretically possible, I suppose. I have no idea on this record what exactly happened. Having said that, however, I think that if that's where this court were to go, and I don't think it should, but if that were this court were to go, considering the amount of moving target we've had here, I would strongly suggest to you that you don't simply say he gets no sentence credit. I think it gets returned to the court for a chance to prove what actually happened here, given the moving target.
Was he given the credit on the Illinois case?
I have no idea.
I know that.
I have no idea.
Counsel, before you go over to your chart, let me just ask you one question. In 973-155, the word custody is used.
Yes.
Do you think that has any special meaning in the law, or do you think a detainer qualifies as in custody, or do you think a detainer does not?
Under DeMar's, a detainer is not in custody.
Okay. I just want to make sure we're on the same page.
Yeah, and it has some meanings beyond that. I mean, there's some inpatient stuff that's sometimes in custody, but I don't think any of it's particularly relevant. Right. I gave, because I know that this is a little hard to see, I gave the marshal handout for the copy. So
have you seen this, Mr. Weinstein? Okay, fine. You have no objection to this. Okay.
And these really are, now that I've learned to work the computer better, cleaned up copies of some of the charts, with one exception, that you've actually seen before. They're just a little easier to see. I didn't do them with ruler and... Okay. We were talking earlier about Betcher, and I would agree that Betcher absolutely makes sense and is correct when you go to comparing a rich defendant and a poor defendant, which is what they were trying to do. I think Betcher is correct that in a consecutive sentence, if you were to give dual credit, you get a windfall. What happens as a practical matter is if you have a defendant, and in this case I've got two 12-month, and I'm only giving give you the initial incarceration portion because it just gets too confusing to read the charts if you put the rest of it on there. And on this one, unlike what you've got in the brief on page 22, you can actually count the little boxes if you need to. There are some people in my office who went back and found it much easier counting the little boxes. What happens if you have two consecutive 12-month sentences, rich defendant never spent a day in jail, he spends 24 months in custody. If you have a poor defendant who's been in custody for 2 months prior to the sentencing date, and those are in yellow, and you give credit one time, you say, yeah, you were in custody on both cases, but you get it only once, so we give him the 2 months. Now, I'm counting from here because he's in custody. Because in custody, in the way I'm using it right now, means was he sitting in the jail or in the prison? I don't care where he was sitting if some guard was saying you can't leave. That's custody for this purpose. And if you give credit, what the prison system would do is count it as though it started 2 months early. Again, that poor defendant spends 24 months. They are spending the same amount of time with a single credit.
Now, this is consecutive sentences.
This is a consecutive sentence.
Okay.
If, as was suggested by the defendant in Betcher, you had given credit on both cases because the time was in connection with both cases, what would have happened is they would have backed it up 4 months. The first two are in white because he's not actually in custody. We're pretending he was. You count the time, and yes, he gets a windfall. He ends up with 22 months in custody. If Betcher had been decided the other way, and we had given dual credit in a consecutive circumstance, there would have been a windfall. No question about that. Which brings us to Ward. And what I've done here with Ward is, this is really the same, this is figure 5, which is on page 24 of the brief. Again,
this is concurrent sentences.
Two concurrent sentences. I have no idea when I made this chart whether the charges on each sentence were similar, different. Didn't matter. I was looking at sentencing date.
Two concurrent sentences. 12 months each.
12 months each, same sentencing date. And you begin to see why you needed to give credit on both cases if what you're trying to do is avoid the equal protection problem that caused the legislature to pass the statute in the first place. And what happens is, the rich defendant has two 12-month sentences starting from the same date, ending at the same date, spends 12 months. By the way, if you wanted to count each of these as two and say they're 24-month sentences, it doesn't matter the length of the sentence. I picked 12 only because it was real easy for making the boxes. There's no magic to it. I was looking for something that was long enough to look good on a chart, and because I was using a ruler initially. If you have a poor defendant who can't make bail, okay, let's say that one of these is an armed robbery, one of these is a sexual assault, happened on completely different days. But he got arrested on the same day. Catch up with him on the same day, catch him on the armed robbery, he admits to the sexual assault. Okay? Spends 2 months in jail before that. But because we're going to say those two weren't in connection because they weren't the same course of conduct, we're only going to give it to him on one. If you do that, that poor defendant, and in this case I don't mean poor defendant is, and I feel sorry for him, I mean he doesn't have the money to get out, is going to spend the 2 months before, plus the way these sentences line up, he spends the full 12 months on that second sentence, he's spending 14 months. He's not spending the 12 months that the guy who can get out on bail is. He's spending 14 months. And that's why in Ward, and that's what they're talking about in Ward when they say you need to give him dual credit or he's going to end up behind. I think that's what they're really talking about. If you give him credit on both of them, because he was sitting in jail on both of them, and understand that if he'd only been sitting for 1 month on one of them, you only give that credit, you don't automatically equalize the credit out. It's the credit that goes to each case based on the rest date. Then he's going to spend 12 months in custody. Now, part of that may have been spent in the jail and part of that in the prison. Body may be in a different place. But he's going to spend the same time which defendant. Okay. Which brings us to the circumstance I think we're talking about here. And part of the reason I made these charts is because this is one of those rare cases in which I think a visual argument is easier to follow. Okay. What we've got is a defendant who can make bail. Again, I used 12-month sentences, tried to keep it consistent, so it was less confusing. He's getting sentenced 2 months apart. I'm not sure why. Maybe, let's assume that these are connected. But he pleads on, there are a couple of charges, he pleads on one, goes to trial on the other. Sometimes it happens that you end up with sentences, even in connected cases, on different days. Might be two different cases entirely. For the defendant who makes bail, he has the 12-month sentence, he has the second 12-month sentence. The way that they won, he spends 14 months in custody. Let's say the poor defendant sits in jail for a month on both cases. He's arrested at the same time, 1 month before the first sentencing, whether the cases are connected to each other or not. He spends that 1 month. If you give him credit only on the first case, he is going to spend more time in custody by exactly the same amount he sits in jail. And that's going to be true no matter how you slide these closer together until they become consecutive, and then you've got a different situation altogether. But as long as these are overlapping, giving him credit only on the first case is going to cause him to spend more time in custody.
Counselor, isn't this really one of those cases where it doesn't matter so much what the rule is, except that the rule be clear for the sentencing judge? Because when the second sentence is meted out, the judge will know what the first sentence is. And if, in fact, he wants him to stay in jail for 14 months total, he'll adjust the second sentence to accommodate that. If he wants him to stay in jail for 2 years, he'll adjust the second sentence in accordance with that. So, you know, the problem to me here seems to be, what does the statute require? And then when the sentencing judge knows that for which he can give credit and can't give credit, he will confine the defendant to the time total that he thinks is appropriate when he's using concurrent sentences.
I would both agree and disagree with you. I would agree with you to the extent that I think the clearer and simpler we can make this for everybody, the better the judge is going to do at exercising discretion.
Right.
I have no doubt about that. And frankly, I think the way we've been doing it, concurrent, everything that's in connection is on both sentences or three sentences, consecutive not, is probably the simplest rule you could possibly have, and it will cover every circumstance. But having said that, I think that in the ideal situation, you are absolutely correct. What I'm concerned about is taking the idea that then it doesn't matter, because let's say that the attorney does not do his job. I hate thinking defense attorneys don't do their job, but sometimes it happens. Sometimes it happens from laziness, sometimes it happens from mistake. And let me tell you, having done a lot of sentence credit, lawyers are terrible at adding, subtracting, multiplying, and dividing, and unfortunately so are judges. If it's figured correctly, you'd be absolutely right. What I know, though, is sometimes it's not, and I am concerned about catching people. If the judge has distinctly said when he's sentencing, or she's sentencing, yes, I'm taking sentence credit into account, then you may have a sentence mod and we can sort this back out. If they haven't said that, then you may have a circumstance where you say, well, it doesn't matter, but it may very well matter to the defendant which rule you have.
But counsel, I think in case law, trial court judges are not supposed to say that you're taking sentencing credit into account.
Echols says you can. I don't know whether you can say it. I know that Echols suggests, and I've got the cite for it, but it's back over there if you want it, says that you can. It says that a judge may consider pretrial incarceration.
Okay.
All right. The one other thing I'd like to point out, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, and I'm bringing this up only because the state in its reply brief suggested that there was a circumstance that would not work out the way that I said that it did. And that's on page 6 of the state's reply brief. That chart is not in my brief, obviously. I couldn't know what example they had. I just want to demonstrate for you, and I'm not going to run through it very closely, that in fact it works out exactly the same way as I indicated on my charts. It doesn't matter as long as the two sentences are overlapping. And understand that if they're not overlapping under Moore, they're consecutive and we treat them like Betcher.
Does it matter which one's the longer one?
No, because I've arbitrarily put them sentence ones. I don't think it really does.
It wouldn't matter whether Illinois was longer than Wisconsin here or Wisconsin was longer than Illinois.
No, what you've got are sliding bars. One sliding this way, and the question is, do you slide the other one too, or do you leave it where it is? I mean, in a real crude kind of analysis of it. It's going to work out exactly the same way.
I read the bar chart in the appendix of the reply brief, and the bar chart relates to pages 5 and 6 that you refer to. And it seems to me there's an error in the state's bar chart. No, it's in the reply brief, counsel. It's where in the last bar chart, says that it's only 13 months. Didn't show the pretrial confinement in that.
Exactly what happened. What I was going to say to you is I think what happened in this chart is in a lot of circumstances, there are two dates that really are the same. Going into custody and being sentenced. And I think it's really easy to accidentally confuse those two. And if there's pretrial credit, those two are not the same.
That's what's missing in that last.
Yes, there's a piece at the beginning and that I think it's a month he's taking off at the end between C and D.
Right.
What he's missing is that's really on the beginning, sort of
right.
Pre-A. Yes, I would agree with that.
And then you reach the same amount of
exactly.
Time.
Exactly.
And you're arguing this whole case, as I understand the argument, that he is sitting in the Illinois jail in connection with both the Illinois arrest and the Wisconsin arrest.
Yes.
And where you're sitting in jail on two matters, the state is forgetting a couple of days, and I think that's right here. We are sitting on two matters, and you're having concurrent sentence at different sentences imposed on different dates. The question is, how do you credit the pre-sentence confinement? That's the issue as you see it in this case.
As I see it at this point, yes. And the answer, I think, is if they're concurrent and you're sitting on both cases, it goes to both cases. For any time that goes to either case, if they're consecutive, it goes to the first case. If there's some leftover time, it goes to the second case, but that's always been true. So you're only crediting it once.
The consecutive.
For consecutive
twice
cases.
Concurrent,
yes.
Even on non-same-day sentencing.
Yes.
As I read the briefs, which doesn't mean I read them correctly, the state was arguing the same point in the briefs. The only difference is their conclusion was different.
I'm not sure.
Okay, why not?
I've been having some trouble being sure what exactly the state was arguing, and I really don't want to characterize their argument because I've had such trouble getting my head around where it's been at different points.
Well, you did in your brief, you characterized it.
Yes, and that's where I thought they were, and then I listened to Mr. Weinstein earlier, and now, frankly, I'm not clear on exactly.
That's what I want to know. But as of the time of briefing,
as of the time of briefing,
you thought.
Yes.
Now, the argument raised a different issue. I understand.
Yes. If there are no further questions.
Does anyone have any questions about that, Justice Brasser?
When Wisconsin puts out a warrant for somebody's arrest,
mm-hmm.
Does that go in a computer? I imagine it goes into a computer.
I believe it goes into a database. Which one it goes into, I may have known at some time, and I don't know at the moment.
Okay. Do we have a copy of the police report from the Illinois robbery?
I'm not sure whether that's in the record or not. I would have to check. I don't think it's in any of the appendices. What I know we have is I know we have the felony warrant. We have what Cook County calls a verification of incarceration.
Yeah, and the date on that is 6-9-0-6.
Right, because that would have been requested. What that is that's when you go back to the jail and say, we know you were holding this guy. What were you holding him on? I don't know whether the other one's in the record. I would have to check. If you want me to check, I can write a letter to the court and let you know. But off the top of my head, I don't know the answer to that.
What's the purpose of what are we checking it for?
It seems to me, now this is just my hunch, and the facts may be different from my hunch. But if I'm a police officer, and I see Justice Ziegler committing a crime, or I believe she has committed a crime, and I go out and arrest her and bring her back to the jail, and she's booked in, the computer is going to tell me, oh, there's also a warrant for her. I just kind of doubt that the Cook County gendarmes were acting as agents of the state of Wisconsin when they went and made the arrest. They had a robbery to deal with.
My recollection is, and I would have to check this, and this may be incorrect, my recollection is that he gets pulled over in a car. And if I'm remembering this correctly, and as I said, I would have to go back and check, they're probably running the warrants before they do anything else. I don't recall that they picked him up at the scene of the robbery. I don't recall that that was what happened, but I would have to check.
Chief, if I may, one other question. The Department of Corrections, when they compute when the sentence starts for purposes of the length of incarceration, they put what would be the yellow portion of your chart, that is, the credit for time served to... They back it up rather than put it on the tail end. Is that correct?
Yes.
And what reg of the Department of Corrections interprets that, if any?
I don't recall that. Actually, I think there is a reg. Just a minute.
I can look in your brief. I just
didn't say. I'm pretty sure it's in the brief.
Okay. I'll look in the brief and get it. But I know that that was the argument. The Department of Corrections. You argue or advance, unlike the state, puts it at the beginning, and that's when they determine the sentence to begin for purposes of the period of incarceration, as opposed to tacking it on the end.
Right, and I was looking at the regulations. I don't, off the top of my
head. I'll find it. Does it matter in
okay, your chart? Okay, it's going to be in 302.21 somewhere. It's on page 13 of my brief.
Does it matter on your charts here? That isn't the point you're making on your charts.
No, I was just explaining how that's not the point I was making on the charts. I was, in trying to do it, I was explaining conceptually how sentence credit works out.
So that you work out with the same actual amount of time, but you put it at the back end, because what it does is reduce the, it hastens the time for release.
Well,
put it at the back end.
It hastens for the department's position time of release. What I think it really does is shift the sentence.
Okay.
It just shifts everything.
Spend the same amount of time.
Right, and that's part of why the department does it that way. It's I think it may be just ease of calculation, frankly.
I want to ask you a question about if you had everything in Wisconsin and the arrest was first made on robbery, Ms. Hennick.
Okay.
Then it turns out that in a different county, or maybe the same county, there's an outstanding arrest warrant for the sexual assault. Now he's sitting in jail originally on the robbery for the 324 days that he sits here. is ultimately convicted of sexual assault. Does he get 324-day credits? I think that's the point of Justice Prosser's question.
I think what he gets, and I missed catching the relationship between the two. He gets the time for anything after, which, all right, if he's arrested on the robbery first,
right,
and then arrested on the sexual assault.
No, he's already there. I don't have to arrest him again.
But the assault, let's say the sexual assault is not issued till later. Okay? Doesn't get any time until they pick up the sexual assault. I would argue that time is not related because he would have been in on the robbery.
Why do I have to ever arrest him on the sexual assault?
Well, but what I'm saying
now
is...
Now we have a DA that charges both crimes.
But I'm saying until it gets charged, until he in some ways... You know, when they arrest him on the robbery, they don't even know about the sexual assault. I'm not going to stand here and make the argument that you send everything back. The exception would be if the sexual assault happened during the robbery, where I think the two are related.
Separate.
If they're separate, I don't think you send everything back. That, I think, would be a windfall.
What you mean by send it back is that you get credit for both.
You don't get credit for both for the period of time nobody knew about the sexual assault.
All right, now, so he spends a month there on the robbery. Then the DA picks up that there was a sexual assault, and the DA brings charges for both the robbery and the sexual assault. He's still sitting in jail, of course. He can't get out, right?
Okay. Can't make bail on either case.
Right. All right. So now he's charged with both, and he's sitting in jail, having been originally arrested only one charge. He is then convicted of only the second charge, the sexual assault, the one that he was not originally arrested for. Does he get credit for having sat for the robbery? Does he get credit for all the time in jail, part of the time in jail, none of the time in jail?
I think he gets it for the time starting with that sexual assault charge. So there should be a month for which he was sitting on only the robbery, for which he does not get it, because that would not put him in any different position than anybody else.
I think that is the point of Justice Prosser's question to you, that if he was arrested for the Illinois charge, he's going to sit there anyway. And maybe was never kept because of the Wisconsin charge. Or later they find they have two reasons to keep them in, but they don't have to do any paperwork, and we don't have any of the paperwork here on the Illinois matter. I've just looked through the record, and I didn't see it. It's not a very long record.
It's not a very long record, no.
And what about the booking? I thought Mr. Einstein said that the booking reflected... I understood him to say that, so I thought it probably was in the record, unless he was divining something, which might be possible.
I honestly, at this point, we've talked about so many pieces of paper, I'm a little confused about what's actually in the record. I would need to go back to it, and I apologize for that.
Well, your brief says Carter was arrested in Cole County on both the Wisconsin case and the Illinois charges of robbery and drunk driving. That was December 14. A Wisconsin fugitive arrest warrant, a fugitive warrant was served December 16. He's given a 7-day on DUI, which he completed on the 23rd of December. He continued to be held in Cook County. Then you had a governor's warrant, right?
Right, and just to confuse this, I think the original attorney requested, as part of that 324 days, that 7 days on the DUI case. That should not have been requested, because he was sitting on another case under Beats. I didn't catch that till just now.
Say that again.
The 7 days he's sitting on the DUI, I believe the other attorney requested those days as well. If I'm correct, it shouldn't be 324, it should be 324 minus the 7. Because when he was sitting on an actual, serving an actual sentence under Beats, he does not get credit.
Just like he doesn't get any credit for being in the Illinois prison. We're only talking about pre-conviction
Right. And if those 7 days are included in the 324, and I have a feeling they may be, then that's an error, and I just caught it, and I apologize for not catching it earlier.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Weinstein.
Thank you. Quickly, in terms of the record, and I'm not totally sure that I remember the every detail of the record. My recollection is there are no police reports. My recollection is also, I don't know what I called it a booking, but that's my characterization. There's something in the record that indicates that when the police officers made the arrest, somewhere along the line, somebody decided that there were, quote, extradition cases. I have no idea what that means. My hunch is that this guy was actually stopped because of the DUI, and that when they ran him, they turned up either only the Illinois robbery or both the Illinois robbery and the Wisconsin felony. I don't know which that is, and I don't really know that that's what happened, but that's my guess, because it's very common to have people stopped on a significant traffic offense, if you will, and then when they run them, they find the outstanding warrants. But I do think that kind of points up some of the fortuity of this entire area, which is, if for some reason the police officer doesn't run, or if there's some mess up in the computer system and the warrant doesn't get in there or doesn't get communicated, then there's no credit, even under Mr. Carter's view. So it seems to me that that's one of the things that underlines this concept, that to get the credit, you really ought to have some connection with the underlying facts of the cases.
I want to return, in the brief time that we have, to what I thought your argument was, and it may or may not still be, I just don't know. I thought your argument here on review is that Ward doesn't apply. Is that the argument that you're making here?
I did not choose to ask the court to overrule Ward, because the facts of this case don't match Ward.
Well, let's go to the facts of Ward. Now, as I understand it, there were two different dates of sentencing in Ward. Am I correct?
No, well, I don't think so.
Take a look at the briefs in the Court of Appeals. The state's brief and the defendant's brief seems to say that that's the case. That is, that the one sentencing was done by Judge Schudson on February 7th, 1989, and the other one 2 days later on February 9th, 1989, by Judge McCormick. And it's the McCormick sentencing that was the basis of the Ward appeal. Now, as I understand the facts of the Ward case, he was arrested for cocaine, and that's the one Schudson sentenced him to on February 7th of 1989. But when he was arrested for cocaine, lo and behold, didn't he have out on probation for 3 marijuana? That's McCormick's. And so when McCormick sentenced him 2 days later, McCormick imposed a prison term of 3 years and ordered that the terms for each run concurrently. He also ordered that the sentences on the marijuana convictions run concurrently with the prison terms imposed by Judge Schudson on the cocaine convictions. So you have Schudson on the 7th doing the cocaine. 2 days later, you have McCormick doing the marijuana. McCormick gave, I think, maybe 233 days, or was determined 233 days were appropriate for the pre-sentence credit But the state and Ward, both at the trial court level and at the Court of Appeals, conceded and acknowledged that there would be sentence credit on McCormick's for the same period of time as there was on Schutzen. Two different offenses, two different dates of conviction, two very totally year-separated offenses. And the state conceded that at the trial court and conceded that at the Court of Appeals. And the only issue was McCormick did something a little odd. And that is that when he allowed for the sentence credit, he only did it on one of the three. And the state agrees that McCormick was wrong and Ward, and the defendant said McCormick was wrong, and the Court of Appeals said McCormick was wrong. So there was a chorus of all of you saying, no, he had to do it on all three. But you conceded, the state conceded at the trial court level and the Court of Appeals level, that they got sentence credit for both offenses, for the cocaine and the marijuana. Was the state wrong in Ward?
If the facts are as you say, then yes, the state was wrong. And by the way, the state in Beats conceded that the pretrial credit for that case, in which the circuit court awarded pretrial credit on both the first sentence and the second sentence, was the state conceded that too.
Let me follow up then. It was the Court of Appeals wrong in Ward because they clearly based their opinion on the facts set forth in the briefs by the parties.
Well, if the facts are as you say, which is that the concurrent sentences were imposed on different days, then in my view, that's wrong.
Ward decision is wrong then.
Right.
Because if Schutzen did it on February 7th of 1989 and McCormick did it on February 9th, 1989, you're saying Ward should be overruled.
Yes.
Now, while you're talking about overruling, do you want us to overrule Roe and Tosha?
So, Roe is a consecutive case.
Okay, so we don't have to overrule.
Don't have to deal with that.
And
I agree with the Demers case too. I think what the Demers case stands for is that a notice between the custodians is not custody, and that's what a detainer is.
So you don't want to do that. And on page 2, I read that you were asking us to overrule Roe and Tosha. You don't think so?
The whole problem with Demers and Roar and all of that is that the special materials, reasons from those cases to the conclusion that one must be in exclusive custody on the Wisconsin crime before you get credit on that crime. Now, you can make that conclusion based on the language of the statute, but you can't make that conclusion based on the holdings of those cases. And that's really the problem that I had when I sat down to brief this case, when the focus on the case in the Court of Appeals had been solely the jury instruction special materials, because that's what the circuit court used to deny credit. And that's what we briefed in the Court of Appeals. And when I look at the cases, I say these cases don't support that conclusion.
Those three cases cited by the jury
right.
instruction committee upon which the trial court relied.
That's right. They don't support the conclusion that you must be in exclusive custody, exclusive being a word that's not in the statute, to be entitled to sentence credit. Now, you can look at the language of the statute and say, well, there are some cases in which the only way that these two cases will be in connection with is if the underlying facts are, depending on how you interpret that language. And certainly, this court's been presented with both broader and narrower interpretations of that language in the past and now again. I guess the only other thing that I would like to bring to the court's attention in terms of the equal protection aspect, And I have not looked at this in any great detail, but I did look at yesterday the federal statute for sentence credit in the federal system. And curiously enough, that statute ends with the phrase, after saying you get credit for the offense on which you were sentenced, or you get credit for any offense that you're arrested on after the charge for which you're sentenced, that has not been charged against another sentence. And what that says to me is there's no constitutional problem if you get credit on a sentence, even though some other sentence means that you spend more time in jail than if you give credit on all of the sentences.
Has the constitutionality of that statute been tested?
I'm sorry?
Has the constitutionality of that statute?
I don't know. I didn't research that.
Mr. Weinstein, isn't it fair to say that a reader's confusion after reading the briefs may be occasioned by the fact that actually there were separate sentencing dates? However, the matter that was appealed was the product of but one sentence imposed on one day following revocation of probation.
In this case?
I'm sorry, in Ward.
In Ward?
Yes, I beg your pardon.
That is the fact. My recollection is that
but
is
there the could fact. Have been different sentencing dates, and for instance, the trial court may have withheld sentence at one of those sentencing dates and obviously did place Ward on probation. But then ultimately, isn't it true that one sentence was imposed on one day for the several different courses of conduct which were all underlying?
I'm not sure I'm willing to say what words the facts are.
I think that's the way I read it. If that's what the official reporter says, then that you probably don't have a reason to disagree with that.
I think that's the way I read the case. I could be wrong.
Things could stand wherever, whatever they say.
I don't know. I think that gets into a whole other issue.
Thank you, Mr. Weinstein, and thank you, Ms. Hennick, for another sentencing credit case. When defense counsel says neither lawyers nor judges know how to add. But we now use computers, counsel. This closes the hearing on 06 AP 1811 CR State versus Carter, and thank you both. We will move into our next case immediately.